Hello, and welcome to the Regrettable Century. This week, we got the gang back together to do the very last part of our Hegel in the Hermetic Tradition series. We've been reading Hegel in the Hermetic Tradition by Glenn Alexander McGee, and if you haven't listened to the first two episodes yet, I suggest you go back and do those. So this week, we are down two members, but we still have myself, Jason, Adam, and Mir, and we will be discussing Chapter 5, The Kabbalistic Tree, which covers the science of logic, Chapter 6, The Alchemist's Laboratory, which covers the philosophy of nature and the philosophy of subjective spirit, and Chapter 7, The Rose and the Cross of the Present, which covers Hegel's philosophy of objective and absolute spirit. All right, enjoy the episode. My notes titled Hermetisegel, Alchemagel.
That's pretty good.
Well, that means my notes should be the Kabbalah Hegel, or the Hegabala.
Hegel.
Kabbalah. There we go.
Kabbalah's good. That's good.
Kaboom.
Nailed
the
it.
The Hegelian Kabbal.
And Jason, yours would be
Crucial Hegelism.
No, Rosa Kragelusium.
These are all good. That's is all staying in.
Yep. This is all important. Finally, we have what we want.
Yes.
That was a whole lot of Hegelian dialectic that just happened right there. Yeah,
we were alphabunging some words.
Yeah, some shit just got alphabunged real hard right there in the episode.
What I came here to do.
I guess we're going to finish this book off. This is the third and final, which I guess it feels appropriate. We ended up doing three episodes instead of two or four.
Right, yeah. Absolutely. This is in keeping with the Hermetic and Christian theme.
Holy triad.
Yeah, the Holy Triad, the Hermetic, the Christian, the alchemical, the Rosicrucian, the Masonic, the...
And the Hegelian. Or the Christian, the Marxist, and the pessimistic.
Yes, all of these things.
They're all the same, really.
Yeah, it's all one thing.
Yeah, it's all part of the Illuminati's plot to dominate the world.
No, the Jesuits.
Yeah, well, the Jesuits control the Illuminati.
Well, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're all here. We all have our Hegel triangles tattooed on our foreheads. We did the initiation right last time. We read the phenomenology. We're all in robes. We're burning incense.
But let's introduce everybody here, because we're down a couple of our crew. Mm-hmm. They didn't make it through the initiation process.
Yeah, they went down one of those blind alleys.
The process of mortification and rebirth. They just mortified, and now rest in peace, Kevin.
Yeah,
rest in peace, Jess. We know you're out there somewhere, looking down on us.
Up from purgatory.
Yes, there we go.
Oh, I was just thinking, looking down on us, like thinking that we suck.
Why not both?
Too busy. They have to be purified by fire in order to realize the true doctrine.
There we go. Jess is too busy, and Kevin is uninterested in enlightenment. Let that be on the record.
You know, speaking of esoteric things, have y'all ever seen the film The Holy Mountain by Jodorowsky?
No, mm-hmm. I haven't actually.
I would highly recommend for a follow-up assignment for us and all listeners to watch The Holy Mountain and to just be aware of the various blind alleys and ways that you can stray from the esoteric path. They are many.
And then afterwards, we'll read Foucault's Pendulum by Umberto Eco, and we could do the same thing. Because that book is rife with blind alleys of esoteric enlightenment.
And then we follow up with The Imitation of Christ by Thomas A. Kempis.
Hi, I'm Chris from The Regrettable Century.
And I'm Jason, also from The Regrettable Century.
This is Adam/Chairman Bain of the now retired Red Library. This is our last episode of all time.
Rest in peace.
R.I.P.
Comrade.
Rest in pieces. And this is Mir from Sweden. Just hijacking The Regrettable Century and Red Library feed as always.
He's our official Lost Horizons member at large.
In exile in the cold north.
The frozen north.
Well, I guess I am going to lead us through Chapter 5. So we did the initiation rite last time with the phenomenology of spirit. And as if that wasn't hard enough, we are now tackling Kabbalah and the science of logic in one chapter. So this was supposed to be led by Comrade Jess, RIP Jess. I'm going to pinch hit for Jess on this one. Because this is a pretty gnarly thing to tackle, McGee does the great service of giving us a summary at the end. And you were thinking like we could sort of maybe use the summary as our starting point for the chapter.
Yeah, use that as our outline for the chapter, really.
Yeah. Well, I think maybe to start, before we dig into the outline, I think McGee does have a couple of pretty good ways to just frame the nature of this chapter and just Hegel's science of logic in general. So has anyone besides myself read The Science of Logic, who is on the gang today?
I have not. Okay. That is further into Hegel's system than I have gotten.
Well, I will say I have looked at the words on the page. I have gone through all the page. Whether I could actually say I've read it or not, I'm not sure. But it is a completely terrifying thing to encounter. It is like 800 pages of some of the most, McGee has this great word about it where he calls it verbose and obscure compared to terse and obscure with Hegel's philosophy of nature. So you can imagine Hegel is just in general verbose and obscure, but this is like him at his most, like the alpha, sigma, slash theta level of obscure and verbose. So it is a terrifying thing to deal with, and I don't think I ever want to do it again. I think whenever we're looking at that, then compared to Kabbalah and how these two relate to each other, you know, it's quite a project. Although I do think this outline is going to give us a pretty good way to find our way through it. So McGee also says that it is a simultaneous account of what it means to be an account of the highest individual being, and I just have fucking Chad shit in my notes. So that is what Hegel is doing. No surprise. Something I would be curious to get y'all's thoughts about before we dive into the outline. He also says that it was Hegel's attempt to provide Germany with its own metaphysics. Again, no small project. I don't know if anyone had thoughts about the just ridiculousness of Hegel's project or maybe the appropriateness of Hegel's project.
I really like the idea of, like, you know, Germany needing its own specific metaphysics that is, like, just purposely obscurantist and difficult and verbose,
right,
with you know, page long sentences that are totally unintelligible to anybody who doesn't already know what he's talking about.
It's the only way, like, to do it.
Very German.
Yeah,
I feel like there is in some ways, isn't there already a German metaphysics, you know, in a lot of the Pietist branch of Lutheranism and in all of the philosophy that Hegel is, you know, encountering and working through and synthesizing?
Yes.
Is he really is he providing a metaphysics? Or is he really?
He's synthesizing.
Implying,
yeah.
And
yeah.
So, like, and that is in the US and in the Anglophone world, the Romantic tradition is usually not considered that reactionary. But in the German-speaking world, Romanticism has, which Hegel is one of those figures who can be read as a Romantic or can be read as an Enlightenment figure, both at the same time. And I am thinking of Heider, who is one of the other famous German Romantic figures who also tried to follow up that Hegelian project from a much more... He started out as Lutheran and ended up an atheist with the German metaphysics very much grounded in blood and soil. I think they were quite contemporary, Heider.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, me either.
Something I don't... that's not someone I'm familiar with.
Yeah, he is one of the famous German romantics. Basically, German Dicko. What could be more said about... Yeah, but like in the German language, since German reunification was so late and so dominated by Prussia, the idea of a coherent German metaphysics system of beliefs, of language, of a unified folk spirit, national consciousness was basically up until the Second World War, something that was always under construction because of the late unification. And I think that that part of Hegel's project can be read in that tradition, as well as actually Meister Eckhart can be read in that tradition as planting seeds when he more or less created the German philosophical language.
One of the things before we dive into the outline that McGee gives, which I think is comparing how Hegel's, I'm just going to call it Hegel's logic, I'm not going to call it the science of logic, but how the logic and Kabbalah sort of like where their similarities lie. I think it's important that we do talk about a little bit of what Hegel's science of logic is sort of on its own. And I think McGee has some really great ways to summarize it. So he basically says, the reason why it's the science of logic is because logic for Hegel relates to the logos, which is the word, obviously the capital W word, as the creation of the universe, and its return to the word allows history and nature to be the medium of speaking and understanding of the word. So the whole reason why it's like the science of logic isn't so much like, I mean, it is obviously like these sort of abstract categories, which we'll get to, where like the concept of the begriff. But it's really about you have to sort of go through the word to allow nature and history to be this sort of mediating realm where the word comes back to itself and knows itself and recollects itself. And I mean, after reading the logic and then reading this, I have to, as with the phenomenology, I'm like, this is so much easier to understand now to just think about it in this context. I think it actually clarifies Hegel's project immensely.
So like, in order to understand the world, Christ became a part of the world, and we can only understand the world by viewing it through Christ's return to God, in which we create God by viewing the Logos.
Right. So I think that one of the other things we have to keep in mind too is that with Hegel's system, kind of in true fashion to like his approach and the general Hermetic approach as well, each of Hegel's primary works is one moment in a much larger dialectical process. And that's really key, is you cannot sort of separate them and be able to understand exactly what he's doing. So for the logic, this particular work, what we're dealing with is Hegel's sort of like working through of a system of pure reason and thought. And so I mentioned that in the logic, the primary concept he's developing is what's called the concept with a capital C, or the begriff, and it's both science and ontology. So I think what's really key here, just to go back to the idea of recollection being a core thing in the Hermetic interpretation of Hegel, is that what the begriff is, or the concept is, it's essentially the product and content of thinking, but it is a self-subsistent thing. What McGee says is Hegel's absolute idea. And I think the main thing here is that concepts do not depend on us thinking them. They are things that we recollect through this process. So I think that's kind of the real key bridge there between the earlier chapters and this one, is it's Hegel sort of going beyond what he saw, I think, a lot of the other, let's call them like Hermetic or alchemical thinkers doing, you know, the critique about they're still too like in the body. This is him really explicating the realm of like pure thought, which is a necessary thing that can be known through humankind engaging in this philosophical approach, which is part of the dynamic process of, you know, God coming to know itself through humanity as sort of this mediating dialectical process.
Is that, that's what's meant, right? When this is on page 152, when he says that philosophy is a cognitive knowledge of the non-worldly, of all that is eternal. That's basically what that is summing up, right?
Mm-hmm. I think this is also a good point to start digging into McGee's outline, because in a way, I think what we also have to really stay rooted in is how this is sort of, in a way, like exploring the realm of like God, or this whole like dialectical process that exists before humanity like is mediating it. And so I think if we start with the first point, so the similarities between the logic and Hegel's approach and Kabbalah is that, kind of similar to what we've been saying, that the way that God is conceived is that it is dynamic, it is a process, it is not a static thing, it is something that is always constantly in motion. And one of the things that we'll talk about as well is that in both of them, in Kabbalah, what is called the Ein Sof, or the absolute all, is equivalent to like what Hegel calls being, which is nothingness. So, and this is why this shit gets so hard to tackle so fast, because of these equivalences, is that like there has to be this idea of nothingness, which is then mediated through something and then comes to know itself as both something and nothing, as like one whole process. And I think that's a really key point that McGee hits on in the outline. And I think it's why this is so difficult to read for everyone, period, is because of this like dialectical relationship between nothing and something. And how do you make sense of like, even though they're like mutually opposed terms, you have to have both of them to define themselves. And it's not one or the other, but it's both of them relating to each other. So I think one way to read this is almost like a philosopher, like the philosopher, or someone finding knowledge, right? Not seeking after it, but finding it, is in a way explicating the realm of the nothing, or sort of either like the Urgrund, or like the sort of in Hindu cosmology, it would be the realm of God, which is only represented through pure black space. Like it is completely unknowable. And it is only through us sort of as humankind, like sort of working through this process, that we can understand that that is the ground of being, but we only experience it as a nothingness. And I think that's kind of what Hegel's trying to do, is like, how do you come to understand the nothingness, or like the absolute unknowability of God? So it's not unknowable, it's describable, but you have to do this to do it, which is why
it's
hard.
You have to go through the process of becoming. You have to be a part of the process of becoming for the unknowable to become knowable, for the non-existent to become existent, right? Like, I was, the first time I ever heard the process of becoming, I thought, like, that's just like, it doesn't say anything.
Right? Yeah, it's just a bunch of gobbledygook.
Yeah, which is like, you know, that's what most people, I think, rightly, even, just let's say justifiably, feel whenever they hear any Hegelian turn of phrase. It's like, yeah, it doesn't fucking mean anything. That's just a bunch of gobbledygook. It's a bunch of gibberish. But the process of becoming, as a quick way of explaining, the move, like the proletariat in the process of becoming and then only being finally actualized in the moment of its negation of the thing which brings it into existence in the first place, makes so much more sense to me. And that's sort of like my filter through which I look back on this concept.
This is basically a response to Kant, that we cannot know the thing in itself.
Right.
And Hegel's answer to that is basically mysticism.
Yeah.
Like, this is also, I mean, I always return to psychoanalysis because I think that it's so obvious that Freud studied Feuerbach and Lacan studied Hegel under Kojève, because like the concept of trauma is basically this concept of nothingness beyond.
Yes. Which I would say, as like a therapist and, you know, someone who studies psychoanalysis, one of the ways I think Hegel captures what trauma is like most purely is it is pure negation. It is the encounter of nothingness and pure negation and learning to tarry with the negative, which I think is why the bridge between the two is so beautiful. And I think it's, in a way, like to talk about trauma, I think you have to be Hegelian in a lot of ways to capture like it as part of a whole dynamic process.
This chapter really helped me kind of like fully appreciate why it is that in Hegel's lectures on the history of philosophy, or in his like philosophy of religion, he says that Christianity is kind of like the purest religion. It's the purest form expression of religion, because it's the one that teaches that the eternal, or you know, the logos or truth or the absolute or God, right, is knowable, and that through the mediation of congregational worship, whatever, through being a part of the congregation, you are more fully engaged. You're engaged in the process of knowing God, right?
Mm-hmm. When you are engaged in the body of God.
Right. Because you are literally a constituent element of it, and you are conscious of it. So it just makes sense now that like religion is the mode in which truth is present for all men, is what he refers, you know, and then Christianity is the highest expression of that. And then philosophy is the highest expression even of religion itself.
Hey, man, you're cutting into my section.
Yeah.
I mean, it's in every section.
Yeah, yeah. And so the idea, I think, also in this section is that religion is for everyone. Philosophy is only for a few. Let me come back to the outline and something I think is really key. So the bridge between the logic and Kabbalah is, again, the idea of the Ein Sof, the absolute all. And Magias says that the point at which Kabbalist discussions of God's nature begins is with the Ein Sof, like the nothing. And it's basically held to transcend the distinction between subject and object. And its telos is to develop into what is called the absolute subject, which I have to memeify this. I couldn't help but read that as to develop into the absolute unit. So, never mind. I'm not going to explain that to any of you.
So Kevin's definitely waiting for you to explain it.
Yeah, I'm not going to. I will never explain myself. I will never apologize. Really fast, I think that McGee does really has a really beautiful way of connecting the dots here. He says that the logic is a system of pure reason and thought, and it is the realm of truth as it is, without a veil, and in its own absolute nature. It's the exposition of God as he is, an internal essence before creation. And he has this really beautiful like chain of equivalences where he says, in the logic, the eternal equals truth, equals logic, equals logos, equals absolute idea, equals God. And that's what the logic is doing, is like recollecting God's eternal essence before creation. And that's kind of the process of us knowing God kind of through, maybe through mysticism, as you were saying there.
And that is our own process of becoming,
mm-hmm.
which is the process of knowing God is the process of knowing ourselves. The process of knowing ourselves is the process of full actualization as self. So the process of becoming is, right, it's the movement of freedom coming into knowledge of itself. It's funny, like every single thing that Hegel says is encapsulated in any one thing he says.
Mm-hmm.
But none of it makes sense unless you put it all together.
Fucking Chad shit, as I said.
I know, it really is.
That's very hermetic of him too, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
Everything is everything else.
Yeah, the all is in all, and the all is of all, and all is contained within the all, or right. something like that.
If I wanted to guess...
I haven't worked my way through the Corpus Hermeticum yet.
Yeah. If I wanted to get super woo-woo about it, I'd say it's fractals. It's fractal in nature.
It's all fractals, so, man.
This entire process is, you know, reminiscent of the quest of apotheosis to the mystic in Christianity, in Orthodox terms. Because this is Christianity. It's just very heretical Christianity. But yeah, the goal of self-knowledge, the goal of philosophy is apotheosis, is to literally become God.
Yeah.
Become one with God, to become God.
The idea that you can become that within this life is heretical within most other forms of Christianity. But
yeah.
If we're thinking about the apocalypse, the great unveiling.
Yeah.
After that, I mean, even an Orthodox Catholic like Josef Ratzinger would claim that, yeah, we will become like gods in the his vision of the world after the apocalypse is that we are basically all building the hosta, the Eucharistic bread of Christ together with God after the apocalypse.
I mean, something else McGee says about this too is he says that in Hegel's logic, like being and nothing are like hyphenated. So it's being. That's my real.
The text
being,
version.
Yeah. Being nothing.
Being and nothing. So it's being dash nothing. He says it transcends the subject-object distinction and it develops into the absolute idea, which is kind of an abstract conception of the self-thinking thought of spirit. Now, Mir, you were talking about like how that this is Hegel's response to sort of the noumenal realm of Kant. And he kind of says that for Hegel, what the noumenal realm basically presents is it says it's things like what things are in themselves. But for Hegel, it's what he calls the absolute unconditioned, which is the world, soul, and God together. So in a way, like for Hegel, by knowing ourselves and you know, going through this dialectical process, we do have access to the noumenal realm. It's just as one piece of a much broader dialectic. Yeah. So I think for Kant, it's like only the human being who does not understand themselves as like part of this larger dialectical process, like would only be able to say the noumenal realm is something we can't know. Like for Hegel, so he has a statement I think is just amazing. He says, the Hegel believes the phenomenology puts one into an altered state of consciousness where the logic flows from nothing. So yeah. That is why the phenomenology has to come first in the initiation, because only through that can these insights and this recollection flow. I mean, whether you would say, you know, effortlessly or however you want to describe that, but
that's
this
definitely effortless.
Yeah, right. So, but that's kind of like why that has to come first. It's so you can then like grasp this much larger process that you're a part of.
Yeah, the phenomenology is for knocking your brain into pieces so that you can't think about anything properly anymore, mm-hmm. so that you can learn to think anew. And then you can finally read the logic, because everything you've ever understood is all gone or is scrambled.
Yeah. You got to break your brain first.
Yeah. You got to break your brain in order to fix your brain.
It's a process of
your soul, the dark night of the soul.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
It is the engaging in the phenomenology is the process of self-abnegation and of self-mortification.
Yeah, because you basically have to give up everything else in your life. So also practically,
mm-hmm. blast your mind apart. It's ego death through.
It is
ego death through study.
It is absolutely. Well, you know, it is.
It was funny when you say like giving up everything. I'm reminded of a meme.
Oh,
this is for Kevin. This is pure Kevin moments right here. You know, everyone knows the meme of like, my hands look like this, so the hurts can look like this, and it's a guy hands holding the phenomenology, and then a credit card being declined.
It's a classic.
It's like really, literally giving up everything in order to go through this process.
I do think a really important connection here to other traditions is that in the yogic philosophical tradition, there is a type of yoga called jnana yoga, which is the study of philosophy and the mind. I mean, but the thing is, in the yogic disciplines, it's considered a much longer path to the same place. It's like, you can go that route if you want to. It's just a hell of a lot harder, and it's going to take you more time.
And that is also, like, basically the Jesuit tradition, which is, like, you could become a regular priest, and that takes 5 years, or you could become a Jesuit, which it takes, like, 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, why not just do the thing which is much harder and takes longer?
Yeah, exactly.
I have a question while we're still early on in this chapter, which is just about the unconditioned as a term. So I wrote down, I do think this might even be verbatim because I'm not looking at it in the book, but I wrote that the conceptual moments of the absolute are simultaneously categories of the real and human thought, all categories as conditions for knowing, the totality of conditions as the unconditioned, which is the thing in itself, which is a unique, self-sufficient individual, and then I put dot, 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 God, world plus soul plus God equals the absolute / unconditioned. And I have to say that now that I'm not in the chapter, now that I'm not sitting here reading it, and I'm looking back on my notes about it, I don't think that I could present that to someone and explain what that meant, the thing I just wrote down. So the question is, could someone briefly recap the unconditioned as a term?
No.
Well, in that case, what I wrote down will have to suffice.
I mean, in the logic, if it's, you know, being dash nothing, the like what nothing is has to be the unconditioned, because to be, this is going to sound like some Heideggerian shit, to be a being is to be conditioned by certain,
that makes sense.
Right, so like certain historical context, material context, like to be in nature. And so in a way, I think it's like you have it. It only makes sense as part of like a broader dialectical process. So I mean, for what this is worth, there's a point where he talks about that Hegel's system reveals itself like each one is a separate domain, but they all are actually related to each other. And so the three domains are the logic, the nature, and spirit. And so for logic, it's the idea in and for itself. So I think in this context, it would mean it is like the idea before it is conditioned by being in nature and in history.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense, actually.
Right. Yeah, isn't it? It made me think of like the unrealized God.
Right.
Like God before God was God.
Right. And so he also says, I think this is really interesting. He says that, so the logic is the idea in and for itself. It's the unconditioned. But what nature is where it is otherized. It's basically the idea experiencing itself as otherness. And then only in the realm of spirit is where the idea returns to itself and knows itself, recollects itself through its otherness and knows itself that, okay, even though, let's just say like someone who achieves this kind of knowledge, right? Someone who finds knowledge, it would be that, well, I know myself as an other to God, but also now I have kind of like the unconditioned, I understand that that is like my foundation, like that is where all of this arises from. And I'm only able to know that fully after being other from it, which is, you know, to be in nature, to be in history, I think.
Yeah, that actually explains everything, and not just the unconditioned. It explains everything that I read out that I said I didn't make sense of before. Yeah. That, you know, all categories are as being conditions of knowing, and this, and the a unique self-sufficient individual, which is free of conditions, right? Which is unconditioned, is God. Mm-hmm. And the summary of all of this could be maybe found in John 1:1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God.
Well, for the sake of time as well, I honestly think I mean, to me, I think that the most of my notes did cover basically like trying to understand what the logic is. I think that the mm-hmm. connection to Kabbalah, even though obviously, you know, we could do a whole episode on just the Kabbalah, but I think it really has to do with, for Hegel, I think what are like the categories of being that he's trying to describe in the logic, which is almost like what are these categories that exist in, you know, in the unconditioned, like before they become fully conditioned. And he basically relates these to the tree of life, the 10th Sephiroth in Kabbalah. And I think that most of what McGee is trying to sort of connect up here is that, and this is actually from the outline, which I think is actually like very useful. So in Kabbalah, the highest development of God's personality is identified, according to Gershom Scholem, who, like, amazing Kabbalah scholar, friend of Walter Benjamin and everything, they're identified with precisely the stage of his unfolding, which is nearest to human experience. And he says, indeed, which is imminent and mysteriously present in every one of us. And that could be the same of said of Hegel's theology as well. So I think the whole point here is to say that if you look at the 10 Sephirot and the Tree of Life in Kabbalah, what we're really looking at are sort of the place where like God's unfolding into humanity are sort of most close. And it comes in these idea of these like 10 concepts or the categories of being, I think. So I think most of my notes are really, I mean, from that point on, are really just trying to talk about how Kabbalah would be a way to think through this and why they're, and basically how it relates to Hegel's logic. Yeah, so he says that God possesses a transcendent element, which is the Ein Sof. So that is the nothing or the unconditioned. So that is the transcendent element, which is always there, but, you know, sort of the ground of being. But that transcendent element is in the context of becoming. And I actually never knew this, but apparently, like, Yahweh is actually, like, he translates it as becoming, which I had never heard that before. It was just amazing to me.
So, I mean, one of the things that he talks about in here is that God is a process,
mm-hmm.
right? Mm-hmm. So the process of becoming, it, as indicated in the name, is both part of Kabbalism and Hegel.
Right.
That's like the number one like thing that he points out. That's his first thing he points out, mm-hmm. is that God cannot be understood as in opposition to the scripture that says God is the same yesterday, today, and forever.
Right.
And that God is unchanging through all time. To Hegel, God is a process that is constantly unfolding. That seems to jive well with the Kabbalistic understanding of God as well.
So the 10 Sephirot, or the Tree of Life, depict the stages and delineate the process of God's becoming. And so there is some like ambiguity of like, well, are those things God itself, or are they instruments of God's expression? And I think the way that he connects it up is, for Hegel, essentially what the 10 Sephirot would be are what Hegel calls universals. So they are, in a way, like nothing at all. They're like an empty yet determinate form. And so I think for Hegel, the reason why the logic is like so important, and like why he approaches it the way that he does, is he's basically trying to describe like what are these categories of God's becoming that are universals. Like there's no specific content in them, but they're empty because of that. But they sort of determine how God unfolds, or as a process in time and in history and in nature. And so you can kind of see like why, I mean, what he's attempting to do is something like, is basically, yeah, to describe like the bridge between the transcendent, unknowable God and our, you know, our most fundamental sense experience that he starts with in the phenomenology. Like, this is, I think, why the logic comes after that, is because it's him being able now to say, because we've gone through the phenomenology and the initiation, we now can find the bridge between us and God, the sort of the unification or the recollection, which is us knowing the categories of God's becoming and unfolding as a process in time.
Well, and that's why the logic is the what does he call it? The animating soul of the whole structure, right? You know, it's it can't be abstracted from the rest. If there is a central piece in the like link of the chain, that's the logic. If I'm understanding the way it's being presented.
Mm-hmm. I mean, honestly, y'all, that's like most of my notes. I tried to keep it fairly terse and not verbose as much as I could. The last thing he ends with is just talking about Raymond Lull and just the tradition of Pan-Sophia and encyclopedism, which basically I think is just another way to say that, you know, Hegel was also part of this bigger tradition of these mystical, alchemical, hermetic approaches, which are trying to synthesize all human knowledge. So I didn't have a ton about that because I just, for me, it was just an interesting history to say, like, yeah, like there was numbers of other, you know, mystics and alchemical thinkers and hermetic thinkers who were trying to do this, people like Robert Fludd and Comenius and people like that.
I think on page 176, McGee does a really great job of kind of summarizing that what he says, the more significant doctrinal correspondences between Kabbalism and Hegel's system.
Mm-hmm.
And it might just be worth going through them one through nine very quickly.
Yeah, I read a few of those. So if you want, I mean, we could just like restate them and just like.
Yeah, I kind of meant it as a restatement. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. And maybe it's not necessary, but it's God is dynamic and in process. The process has moments of God, right? As we said, or as categories in logic. Absolute all and being as nothing. The transcendence of subject object, right? It's another one you mentioned. That God's personality is immanent in each of us. All categories / moments are immanent as a totality. That all moments are the skeleton or soul of nature. Sholem and Kaplan have pointed out that the triadic dialectical structure of thought forms in Kabbalah, which are also, you know, that's the triadic structure is Hegel's whole thing, right? And evil is a moment of God's being, which is like the third time this has come up in the book. So like you said, Adam, it is just like there's an interesting history, and there's as he does in every chapter, McGee makes an effort to constantly reaffirm the direct connection between these. And I think it's interesting. He said that there's a deeper influence of Kabbalah, I don't actually know how to say it.
Yes.
On the logic than even Bum's influence, which is seen in other places. And I think that by restating those nine, like this is Hegel's Kabbalism. It really just makes the point very clearly.
Like Adam mentioned, that Hegel was part of a community of other thinkers who were who believed in pansophism. Just the idea that universal knowledge exists and that like there are multiple facets to understanding it, and as a combined whole, it represents the totality of that knowledge. It's sort of like the basis for a lot of like 19th and early 20th century theosophist ideas about religion, that like the true religion is the combination of Hinduism, Buddhism, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, and at the base of all of these, there's a unifying knowledge that like that holds them all together.
For Hegel, the logic is like a means to understand and order all the knowledge that we have, but it's also the most fundamental kind of knowledge. So it's almost like if we don't have the logic, we can't relate and actually understand all these other various kinds of knowledge.
So this is chapter 6, The Alchemist's Laboratory, The Philosophy of Nature, and Philosophy of Subjective Spirit. So McGee starts this chapter off by saying that if the phenomenology is a grimoire, then the philosophy of nature and of subjective spirit is an alchemical manual, a sort of an emerald tablet for the modern age. And if we don't know what the emerald tablet is, it is a hermetic alchemical text that was fragments of a hermetic alchemical text that came into the Latin from the Arabic. The relationship of Hegel's speculative science to the other sciences, he says, doesn't de-emphasize the importance of the others, but recognize and uses both. So Hegel here is trying to synthesize outdated sciences like alchemy, specifically in this chapter, with the modern understanding of science. He says that the universal of the speculative and the mundane sciences are to be employed. I think that McGee here is making the point that Hegel is, like, at the same time, in Hegel's time, believing in alchemy and referring to alchemical things is pretty normal. But there are elements of this that are archaic and much more mystical than people are willing to adopt. Yet Hegel doesn't shy away from doing that. So Hegel thinks that all science assumes that nature is rational and follows a definite order. And he believes this and says that all science, that his science maps out the eternal objective order. So basically, Hegel takes modern understandings of science, of the natural world. It's easy to see how there is a structure to all of this. And all things have like a symbiotic relationship to one another and exist within a harmonious world that is created to work in this way. And he says his science is able to map out the same thing, but in the eternal order, in the world beyond this, the mundane. Hegel believed that the world is a living organism, like literally believed that the world was a living organism. He regarded Newtonian science as a depiction of what, quote, a dead mechanical system of externally related entities. Instead, he saw the world as a cosmos of internally related organic whole. The entire condition of the atmosphere, including the trade winds, is a vast living whole. And that's a Hegel quote. So whenever he talks about the anima mundi, he literally means the spirit of the world, like the living spirit of Earth. So McGee says that Hegel's system is a revival of the Aristotelian way of thinking about nature, which the scientists of his day considered to be useless. So his philosophy of nature includes a modernized version of the great chain of being, which is the medieval hierarchical structure of all matter that is decreed and ordered by God. Just like Aristotle, just as in Aristotle, each level of nature strives to be an independent, self-sufficient system, just like the absolute idea. Hegel is basically trying to hold on to and bring into relevance outdated things that he realizes are outdated systems that have been ignored or ridiculed by modern science of his time. He purposely adopts them.
He laments that no educated person is permitted to maintain, right, things like, it's a whole series of them, one of them being like the four elements.
Right, yeah. That's the four elements, like his addition of a philosophy or a philosophy of science which includes the four elements is really him being like, yeah, you don't like the four elements? Fuck you. Guess what? I'm going to talk about the four elements. His philosophy of science includes stuff that is purposely going to get him ridiculed.
Basically, if you were to be a Marxist in modern economics.
Yeah,
like salvaging the ruins from the past. That is what we are doing here.
Back to the Aristotelianism of Hegel here. He says that Hegel emphasized the idea of free release based on the medieval notion that God created the world as a necessitated act of generosity. McGee mentions that this is similar to Neoplatonic emanation, which is also a Gnostic term, because the Gnostics are heavily influencing. The dialectical relationship between Gnosticism and Neoplatonism is on display there. So Hegel is a heretic who believes that an abstract and transcendent God is deficient. And we have established previously that God's creation of nature and humanity was necessary for his completion. Like, God becomes God in the act of creation. He's part of that process. So for the absolute idea to become truly absolute, it cannot reside in the realm of ideas. It must become embodied. And that only occurs when the absolute idea enters the world and becomes embodied, an embodied thought that reflects on itself. So that is the ancient imperative of philosophy, to know thyself. That is the realization of that philosophy. To attain self-knowledge is to realize the absolute idea in the world. And the comprehension of the absolute is the absolute comprehending itself. The object of philosophy is God. The absolute idea is God, just as Aristotle identified God as self-thinking thought.
I'm reminded of, I think it was Plotinus who said that this culmination of this process is what he called the flight of the alone to the alone. I think about that a lot as we've returned, like, to talking about this book and going through these chapters of, like, in a way, like, no, knowing yourself like through this process is something that is like profoundly isolating and alienating, but is like almost a precondition to know, like to know God and know yourself as God, like through primarily that sense of like the nothingness, which is like the ultimate state of like being alone, like the only thing that exists. Do drugs, kids.
Yeah, I mean that's true, and it's that's true. That's it helps. No, I like when McGee says that you know, like just recapping, you know, that to be fully realized, the idea must express itself in the world of space and time. And then he says, thus the logic, right, which we just talked about, must be supplanted by the philosophy of nature.
Yeah.
Because the logic by itself is only
ether.
It's ether. It's the fifth element.
So the absolute idea does not represent a system of pure ideas complete unto itself. To be complete, the idea must be realized, and it is thus realized by the human contemplation, by expressing itself in the world. That's, and like you said, the philosophy of nature is important in that process because human beings are physical organic systems. So a complete account of the spirit has to include those things. So Hegel's point, or his aim, is to work out a quote, developmental account of reality as a whole, rendering all things intelligible. So the absolute idea has to be realized in the world through speculative activity of the philosopher. And that is achieved through a long historic process.
Right. Culminating in Hegel.
Yeah. he thinks a lot of himself, doesn't he?
Well, I like that at the very beginning, like the first thing that McGee says in the book is that Hegel doesn't think he's doing philosophy. Hegel thinks he has resolved philosophy.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
He got to where he is by philosophy, but now he's just knowing.
Yeah.
Yeah. He has actually achieved absolute knowing, which makes me wonder about like there's like a disembodied expression that absolute knowing is a permanent agenda.
Yeah.
But Hegel also thinks he's achieved it. Like, what does it mean for it to be permanent? It's something that's always in motion, but also is completed.
For everyone else, it's...
I mean, I don't think it's... I mean, that's probably also true, right? But I think that that there is something about, like, finality that doesn't actually exist in Hegel's thought.
Yeah. Yeah, like, I mean, I think if you read the Lectures on the Philosophy of History, I mean, he ends by talking about, like, the Prussian state is the embodiment of, like, you know, the absolute, like, idea and, like, freedom on Earth, but it will then move to somewhere else. Right?
Yeah,
like
that's
we've talked about. So I think like part of how that works is Hegel is still always referencing that this like Ein Sof, like the nothingness, the unconditioned transcendent element is always there. We're just one moment in a larger process. Like we're not the only moment. We're just one. And there is some transcendent element that we're in relation to.
That also helps contextualize the end of history, which is something what I think we'll get into in the next chapter, right?
Yeah.
But that's the end of history isn't a moment. We're still living in that period that Hegel is describing as, you know, the consummation of the idea of freedom and all of the rest of it.
He says that spirit is the telos of nature that presupposes, spirit presupposes nature and nature presupposes spirit. The purpose of nature is to extinguish itself and consume itself like a phoenix in order to emerge rejuvenated as spirit. So spirit is driven to overcome the subject-object distinction, to eliminate otherness, and that is the aim of all genuine science. So to Hegel, if your science isn't a drive to overcome the subject-object distinction, then you're doing fake science.
Yeah. A lot of people out there doing fake science.
Yeah, STEM?
Fake science.
Well, I kid, some quantum physicists are doing it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, the quantum physicists are the best kind of scientists because lots of people just consider them to be too woo-woo to be taken seriously. And I'm like, no, those are my dudes.
Yeah.
those are the ones who I will read their articles and go, what? But still, I'll read them.
Yeah. It's like friendship ended with STEM. Quantum mechanics is my only friend now.
Yeah. My only scientist.
The fact that he is using the four elements in a talk about modern science really shows that he is wed to their usage in alchemy. Here, he's trying to show the links between alchemy, Kabbalah, magic, and Hermeticism to modern science. And when Hegel speaks of the square, he has the four elements in mind. And you remember the triangle of triangles? It's at one point somewhere in that whole exposition, he talks about it becoming a square. So At the beginning of his remarks on organics, Hegel talks about terrestrial, vegetable, animal organisms belonging to the four kingdoms, earth, wind, fire, and water, and the kingdom of air stands outside of nature. So, and I wrote this, this is in my notes. Touch is the sense of the earthly elements, smell, taste, and taste correspond to air and water, sight to light, and hearing is the reception of the manifestations of internal being. Whatever the fuck that means.
It means something, though.
Does anybody want to explain that to me? What the fuck does that mean? No?
No.
All right. So he relies on the four elements heavily to illustrate the things that he's talking about. And then that is part of his description of how Hegel is influenced by alchemy. But he says, how is this evidence of alchemical influence? So yeah, by that time, no educated person, especially a scientist, would reference the four elements. So he's making a bold statement here by reviving a dead discourse. And he's risking ridicule to hold on to important truth that Hegel says, yeah, of course, it's truth. Is it accurate? No. Is it true? Yes. So, and like, according to Agrippa, the four elements correspond to the four angels ruling over the four corners of the earth, the four evangelists, the four seasons, the four humors, the four princes of devils, and the four senses, hearing excluded, of course, as we have understood.
Yeah.
Yeah, because hearing is just reception of the manifestations of eternal being.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely clear.
Yeah. Yeah, clear.
I unironically believe that.
Yeah. Then we get to the fifth element, the stuff of stars, ether. That he talks about how this it appears as a very important part of Hegel's early works, but wanes in its significance towards the end. The concept of aether is ancient, even though it was accepted scientifically at the time. So Newton's esoteric aether theory was incorporated into his own hermetic cosmology. So Newton is sort of like the figure that spans the divide between magic and science. And Hegel is more Newtonian in his conceptions than he is any of the thinkers who are inspired by Newton. All heavenly bodies and their spheres are composed of this incorruptible substance. So ether is the metaphysical bedrock, the ultimate pliable medium. It is nothing and has the potential to be everything. It lies at the basis of everything in experience, and it is the life force inhabiting the earth. It is the world's soul. Here's another. Hegel's system resembles Aristotle's in that he puts God, or the absolute, at the apex of the system. The absolute is the moving principle, the telos of all reality. And this system, as it comes into fruition in Hegel's later works, it sort of removes the necessity of a dynamic ether that moves all things. Because if God is already in existence, the absolute sort of makes ether superfluous. And it seems like he's drawing inspiration in equal proportions here from hard science and alchemical or hermetic speculation. McGee says that there is a close fit between the Hermetic Magus as an ethereal voyager and Hegel's conception of the philosopher, who, from the standpoint of absolute knowledge, moves within the plane of logic and brings the ethereal idea into full actualization by self-thinking thought.
Also, I just want to say I really love that description. I heard the other day that Beethoven once said that essentially the task of like the artist is to approach God as close as possible, or approach the divine realms as close as possible, and reflect its rays back to the world as much as you can.
And when you listen to Beethoven, it suddenly you can hear that you can hear in his compositions that that's what he's trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Too bad they weren't good.
Ether is not God, but the idea of God, and it must be inferred that in the transformation effected by spirit at its highest level, its realization of the speaking of the ether with itself. It has created God using the aether as its medium, which is, to McGee, the highest form of magic, right?
Yeah. He says this is indeed high magic. And it's true. Like, right, this one of the things that's just the constant theme in the book is that all throughout, every single thing is like, there is an expression of it. There's an element of it. There's a piece of it in whatever it is, Gnosticism, Kabbalah, high magic, alchemy, like you find it everywhere. And I think that that's important to restate, only to be like, it's not just that, just to say that it's not just that Hegel thinks he's brilliant and thus has resolved philosophy, but Hegel is surveying the sum total, at least as he's aware of it, right, of all speculative interaction with the world. Yes, and trying to reconcile all of it together.
He is a mindless maniac. He has hubris, but he also claims that he can only have that. It is not through his own brilliance that he has reached these truths. It is only possible due to the mastery of knowledge and nature that is the result of the developing means of production. Like, he is a proper materialist there. I think that
he really is.
Needs to be stretched.
The process of history is what develops the ability for the philosopher to realize these things that are already known, but are just like they're out there and need to be compiled all together. And it is the tempering of the philosopher through the process of the unfolding of history that allows these things to happen.
Yes, and it is only at the end of history that certain truth can be realized, just like it is only at the first covenant of the Jews that certain truth about God can be realized, or at the coming of Christ, the second covenant, that some truth can be realized. Truth is embodied in historical events and historical processes.
I will say one thing that I have sort of begun to rethink after reading this book is, if Hegel is a hermeticist, the way that McGee describes, I think to me that the end of history, like, is not like a historico-materialist event. I think that's one of the things I think has been helpful for me, is to think about, like, if what Hegel is doing is an alchemical hermetic process, then the end of history would be the same thing as, like, becoming the philosopher's stone, which isn't necessarily like a material, I mean, it has material part, like aspects of nature and blah, blah, but that's not the sole way to think about it. Like, it has these other elements and other sort of aspects of the realms that Hegel's describing, which it functions. So I will say that thinking about the end of history is, you know, if, dare I say, like a return from otherness back to the absolute or back to nothing. To me, that's actually a much more helpful way to think about it, and gets out of some of the real dumb guy interpretations of it, I think.
It resituates Hegel as not a person, as more than just a person who had a radical spirit and then became a conservative, right? Because that's the overly simplistic view of his shift. But again, I guess I'm prefiguring my own chapter here.
I think that's true. Also the fact that, like, to embody absolute truth looks different in different historical epochs.
Yeah.
Like, in ancient Greece, it would probably look a lot like Plato and not Aristotle. and so on.
Like, but in Hegel's time, it looks like Hegel.
And after Hegel, it would look like Marx, not Proudhon.
Yeah, exactly.
It would look like Heidegger and not Karl Jaspers, things like that. I was wondering if anyone was going to challenge that.
Like Zizek and not Jordan Peterson.
There we go.
And Edith Stein, not Heidegger.
On this, he finally decides to tell us about alchemy, like what the fuck alchemy actually is here. Interestingly enough, after like spending the last quarter of the chapter talking about the alchemical influence on Hegel, he decides to tell us what alchemy actually is. So he says the most interesting connection between Hegel and alchemy exists in the parallels between his philosophical project and the alchemical opus. He says that alchemy has to be read as the symbolic expression of esoteric philosophy. So just as the ancient smiths thought they played a role in the gestation of metals, like bringing metals into existence, similarly, the alchemists believed that it was their task to bring them to perfection. The aim was not wealth, but knowledge and the perfection of nature. To McGee here, Hegel's interest in alchemy has absolutely nothing to do with the transmission of base metals into precious metals. And the true goal of alchemy is not even necessarily the creation of gold. the true goal of alchemy is the perfection of nature and the knowledge that one acquires through the process of perfecting nature.
Right, to help spirit free itself from the bonds of the natural.
Exactly, yeah. He talks about the Philosopher's Stone, which was seen as a priceless item, but as common as dung. Sort of like the Cup of Christ in the Last Crusade, you know?
Yeah.
I've once heard that the Philosopher's Stone also symbolizes every atom or photon of light.
And what he says here, it's the corporealization of the ether. So yes, the substance that all the cosmos are made up of. More commonly, it is thought to, in popular culture, to be like the elixir of eternal life, cures infirmities, creates gold. But to the medieval alchemist, it was primarily sought as something that could isolate the essence of other substances.
Right.
Like it could purify things.
We in philosophy is referred to as getting to the root of the thing, right?
So each element makes up all of physical reality, and each element contains all of the other, and each can change into other things. So the Hermetic theory of the microcosm and the macrocosm, the structural similarity between the human being and the universe is illustrated here. Like Hegel says, you see the parallels between the elements and the human being and God and the universe and all of
it. Right. And it's also reflected in all the quantum mechanics papers that we read and have our minds blown but don't really fully understand.
Yeah, because no one does.
But it's all the same stuff, right? It's all still the same studies of the micro and macrocosms of the logic of the universe as being observable at an atomic level.
We talked about this for a second, that the initial stage of this process in the alchemical opus involves putrefaction or death. So in order for new life, the philosopher's stone, to come into be, mortification must occur. And then he talks about how indebted he is to Paracelsus, the idea that the world is the emanation of the one, the Trinitarian system, the philosopher's stone is conceived of as the union of the three, so too all creatures are created in the number of the Trinity. Man is the quinta essentia, who contains the spirit and essence of all other things. So just the two great Paracelsian pillars that are important to Hegel's thought are: the created world has been given over to man in order that he might fulfill it. God created the world in an imperfect state, and man's original mission is to perfect it. And he has been excreted from the world as its savior. And then everything is related to everything else. Behind the world is the other world of the spirits. What unites us with this is the will moved by imagination through which God generates the astral bodies. To him, the materia prima is the logos, which became flesh, holding within it the seeds of everything else. This is Paracelsus, right? And then, of course, alchemical terms aren't just physical, but also speculative. And I mentioned this to true alchemists: transmutation was a process which transformed the individual from the ordinary mortal immersed in the physical world to the superior individual fully conscious of the mysteries of life and death. Any chemical procedure is supposed to be activated by psychic or magical art, and in the process, in order to carry out the psychic or magical art, you have to go through the process of personal purification. And then, if you look at the medieval tradition of alchemy, that personal purification is heavily reliant upon your piety and your knowledge of the word of God and your dedication to the rituals of the church and everything else, you know.
And and that is living today. When I was taken up in the Catholic Church, I had to fast for a time before I was officially at this ceremony where the cardinal took me up in the church. I had to fast, and that is quite common today. Another symbol of purification is baptism, like where you basically wash away the world in water.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
In the Bible, it talks about dying and being reborn, right? Being born again. That is a process of drowning your old self and then arising from the water cleansed.
There's this phenomenon of people who, I think, in a gotcha moment to Christianity, this they say like, oh yeah, you think, you know, you're so opposed to magic and witchcraft, but your God does this and dies and you're born again and you eat his body and whatever. And it's meant to be like a ha-ha, you idiots, you don't know your own theology. But the truth is that is literally, I mean, not that you don't know your own theology, but you don't realize that you're in contradiction. But it actually is just the theology itself.
Yes. And anybody that knows anything about theology will be like, Chad, yes, when someone like, says that, you know?
Yes.
Yes. And that's the thing. It's like, I'm in a couple of theology groups on Facebook, and there's always the Protestants that are being like, you Catholics are semi-pagan Mary worshipers. And then like a couple of priests that are in there be like, yeah, but so?
Your point being?
And?
Well, but not, like...
They'll defend against the charges of paganism, though, but they'll qualify that being like, yeah, this is the truth that was the rational kernel of truth and that existed in paganism is drawn into the bosom of the church, whatever.
Right. That's, you know, like, just that's what Hegel says as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, if we're about to throw this back to politics, I think that the idea of rebirth and purification and dying from your old self was actually something that was really a big part of the early workers movement, where you had to shed your old preconceptions of society. Like, you were supposed to purify your mind and your actions and dedicate them to the party as a body.
I do think there's a really important thing here about, you know, if the idea of we're going from, let's say, like the proletariat, like, or you know, a subject from being like in itself to being for itself. I think that one of the things that Hegel really, I think, is essential, you know, obviously it's where that language comes from, but the process of doing that is like tearing with the negative. I think that is something that is not like captured very often in like political discussions, even in Marxist ones that I encounter, is like, what does it mean to tarry with the negative through that process? And if y'all remember, I think we mentioned this in one of the early chapters, you know, Hegel says something along the lines of like, anything that proclaims to get from like being in itself to for itself without understanding the severity and the like suffering and the gravity of tearing with the negative, like actually does not offer anything actually substantive in this process. So, I mean, for me, this book has been helpful in just like returning, I think, me back to the idea of tearing with the negative as a profoundly, like, what does that really mean in politics? And I think it's something that has to be taken very, very seriously. It's like a dying of yourself, like prior to being, you know, like a revolutionary, whatever that might mean.
Yeah. Right. So, well, when we talk a lot about, often about the neoliberal subject, as that its maintenance, consciously or otherwise, in the inside the workers' movement or like inside of socialism is antithetical to its very essence.
Yeah. Right?
That you can't just be, you can't be an effective communist if you don't, in a sense, purify that particular sense of self that is basically bequeathed to you, that is an unconscious one. You have to, you know, I wrote in my notes here, this is where we make the case for a communist virtue ethics.
Yeah.
It's right here. Yeah.
And you have to go through the dark night of the soul, tearing with a negative, and also like seeing that, and that is where revolutionary pessimism comes in. Like, seeing and accepting that all is lost and placing yourself within that.
This is just interesting here. Is he says that whenever Hegel is using newer sources, he doesn't stop there. He goes back, he uses newer scientific sources, and then he'll go back further to find archaic, outdated, debunked sources to draw from in order to give the newer scientific sources more of a mystical understanding. Specifically here, one of the most important points that parallels between Hegel's system and alchemy is the idea that metal contains a seed of gold that can be coaxed into gold. So Hegel talks about this with his idea of the cunning of reason, saying that the bad times have a bright side in which they are merely a vehicle, a negative moment through which something positive or better comes to be actualized. We're powerless to force this transition, and all of our exertions are in vain because gold grows slowly. To Hegel, his process is in the phenomenology is akin to alchemical purification. The seed of gold is present in the flawed base metal and is purified to extract that seed. Spirit is separated from its impurities and is reset in every imperfect form the spirit takes. Purification happens through the historical process. Hegel's secret ingredient to this process is the absolute spirit. To Hegel is the world historical alchemist. His product is the philosopher's stone, and he endeavors to create not a godlike form, but God himself. Like the alchemist, the philosopher is trying to free spirit from nature. Just as the alchemist believed that God is slumbering in matter and must be released by man, so Hegel holds that nature is petrified and that God does not remain petrified and moribund. Rather, the stones cry out and lift themselves up to spirit. A little quoting the Bible there. So like Paracelsus, Hegel thinks nature has excreted man and has been tasked with its redemption. So Hegel separates the physical form from its spiritual components of alchemy, disregards the spiritual as the physical as caput mortem, and preserves the alchemist's aim of perfecting nature and completing God. But now the process takes place entirely in the soul of man and is achieved through his speculative activity. So, and I have a little bit more on mesmerism and ESP, which I think is kind of a throwaway bit of that section. The only thing that I think is really important from this is that he believes that the human soul is the same as the soul of the world. So all human, the human soul is part of the anima mundi, that which animates the world. And of course that plays into his everything is everything else.
Right. It is a thing that he says elsewhere in other right. ways.
He believes that, so McGee points out that Hegel literally believes in magic, like, and he says so in his letters. His conception of magic is the idea, like specifically illustrated in the idea that you like mesmerism exists, and that clairvoyance, dowsing, psychic control, and he's thought that these are all magical, but also able to be scientifically understood. Yeah, and philosophy is the highest type of magic. Philosophy is absolute magic, and the control of the mind over the body is magical. And let's see here. He says that the speculative philosopher does not create or invent the dialectic. Instead, it unfolds itself before him. The dialectic is fucking magic.
Yeah, I mean, there's Chad, a reason yes. why there's a reason why there's a large number of people who are on the left who are, you know, let's say even people who are Marxists who say like, yeah, but the dialectic stuff is whatever. It's just like magic, which is to say not worth, that, you know, that the triadic structure is a throwaway concept of Hegel's. Right. But I do think that's why to me, the process of becoming is best illustrated as the class struggle. Right. And the proletariat becomes actual in the moment that it negates itself, because whether it's magic or not, it is actually core to Marx's own conception of
yes.
human like, beings in the world.
And that is a concept that is basically stolen from theology verbatim. You die totally. From your own self and become a part of the church of a larger body in order to purify and sanctify the world, which yeah. is basically what we are doing.
I mean, I would say inherited from theology rather than stolen, but yeah.
Just to
If you don't acknowledge it, it could be called stolen.
I mean, just to add this into another realm where I think this process also shows up. I mean, I think about in a lot of ways, like the therapeutic process of healing from trauma. And I heard recently that someone said that, you know, you start off trying to heal from trauma, and then at a certain point, you realize that what you're engaging in is a philosophical and spiritual like endeavor. Like it's a spiritual discovery process. And I think this is absolutely accurate. And I think it is why that is a very deep part of this process, is to understand kind of like what you were saying, Mir, about psychoanalytic approaches and how that relates to all this. Is it's really an encounter with trauma, which is negation. And what does it mean to tarry with the negative and then go through the dark night of the soul? I mean, to me, this is also a key thing in healing from trauma, which is you literally have to come to self-knowledge and die to all the responses that trauma has caused you to like structure your sense of subjectivity around. Those have to be understood and to gone through and negated to then be reorganized in a new way, which allows you to live your life not basically being defined by the very trauma that created you as a subject.
Yeah. Or
amen.
Or everything is a manifestation of a totality. It's all spirals. It's all real.
It's all one thing, man.
It is all one thing.
It's all being and nothing.
That's right.
Being and nothing. Shit.
Shall we jump on to the next chapter?
Okay, and so finally, here we are at chapter 7, The Rose in the Cross of the Present, which is an overview of Hegel's philosophy of objective and absolute spirit, as well as the mystical and Rosicrucian influence on Hegel's philosophy of history and of nature. And so the first thing I want to say about this chapter is, like we have already said about the last two, there is a lot of continual restatement and recapping of the thesis throughout the book. But I do think that a summary of the specific the essence of this chapter can be said as being that the point is not merely to change the world, but to interpret it.
Yeah.
which I just really like, because if Hegel thinks we live in the period of, if we are living in the end of history, which is to say, we have, through speculative philosophy, have arrived at absolute knowing, and that is a thing that is available to all, first through religion and then through philosophy. And mm-hmm. if he thinks that that the state, which is the product of reason, which is the product of man's raising himself above nature or whatever, and thus is God on the earth, then in a sense man has changed the world, right? And so from here on out, the point is really to understand it. I would say that's not only the restatement of the chapter as a whole, but it's also a restatement of Hegel's project as a whole. So anyways, the chapter begins, I think this is just worth reading out loud, is that according to Hegel, objective and absolute spirit constitute a man-made world that stands in opposition to mere nature. And then Hegel states that after the creation of the natural universe, man appears on the scene as the antithesis of nature. He is the being who raises himself up into a second world. And I think that's worth dwelling on a little bit. What does it mean to raise man above nature and into a second world? So if subjective spirit is that which is common to all of us as embodied individuals, right? That's our capacity for feeling and our recollection and our intellect and our intuition. And objective spirit is then that which emanates from ourselves out into the world, right? The things we create, law, morality, ethics. And then absolute spirit is the reconciliation of subjective and objective spirit through things like art and religion. And even in higher sense than that, philosophy. We have arrived at the stage in Hegel's thought, in McGee's book, and in human history, where man can raise himself up into a second world, to not just be existing in nature, to be master over it and to be steward of it. And that's why the state is God on earth. Not that we should be worshipfully subservient to the state, but rather that we have now created a period, we have arrived at a period in history in which we can create the world through our participation in it. So that, to me, is one of the big revelations of, starting with this book, but then also the extra reading that I've been doing, the extra reading, which is Hegel himself. because I encountered Hegel first and foremost, and for a long time exclusively, through tertiary iterations of Marx's critique of Hegel. So I was taught, Hegel was a conservative who reconciles himself to the Prussian state. And my own sense is that that's actually not the case. So for me, a lot of going through this chapter is moving beyond reconciling himself with the Prussian state and thinking more about the state as the product of reason, which is the product, which is the result of spirit as it moves through history.
Yes, but I have a question. Discussing small groups of five, is it the fact that Hegel believes that we have reached that point, or that we have reached a point of possibility?
Everybody should comment on this. My own sense is that those are the same thing, that we've arrived at the point of being able to do it, and we are doing it, but we won't be done until we won't have done it until it's complete, until the end of history is complete.
It's like the fall of the Roman Empire. Well, how long did that take? from the 5th century until the 16th century. Honestly, I think that my understanding of it was the same as Jason's. I didn't put too much thought into it. That's just what occurred to me as I was reading it.
I do think that going through the chapter, I do think also answers the question, or at least I think it gives us more tools to answer the question. So if the introduction, if that's what I think it states everything in that introduction, that the essence of this is about man raising himself up into a second world, you know, and creating using his capacity to reason and his growing awareness of himself as a free being, which is to say an element of a moment of God that the point is not only to change the world, but to interpret it. McGee quotes a person who I'm just not familiar with at all, Karl Lovith, who says that for an understanding of Hegel's system, his philosophy of religion is even more important than his philosophy of the state, because it's not just one component of the whole system, but is its spiritual center of gravity. I think basically we have endeavored, maybe unconsciously at times and consciously at others, throughout the whole discussion of this book, to more or less make that case, right? That all of this can only be understood if it's centered in Hegel's philosophy of religion, and it sources all of, you know, it looks back at all the sources of his philosophy of religion, but that it can be summed up as God expresses himself through the forms of nature, but only returns to himself and achieves self-knowing through spirit, that is to say, through human knowing, which is to say the process of becoming for God is the arrival of man at the point of the end of history. I think that's where we get into the philosophy of right, which is, this is where Hegel says things like the content of religion is absolute truth, even without the mediation of speculative philosophy, right? This is where we restate that the Holy Trinity is already a representation of, you know, idea in the sense of being essence and concept, but that philosophy is the truth expressed in a more adequate form or in a higher form, that it's long been the unconscious possession of mankind, right? That, you know, that religions sprout up like flames, as he said, as foreshadowing without any knowing, where they come from or where they're going. Why? Because religion is the beginning of divine spirit, not an invention of people. So again, this is all stuff we've already dealt with in other chapters. But I think it's necessary for contending with what I regard as the main question here, which is the state, and it's the relationship of human beings as mediated through the state. So in my notes, I wrote, let's take a detour for a moment and talk about Marx's critique of the philosophy of right. I reread Marx's critique of the philosophy of right, and this is the famous bit about, you know, religion as the heart of the heartless world and soulless conditions, but it's also where Marx says that the struggle against religion is the indirectly the struggle against the world of religion. So, you know, this is the tension that exists in, and I think the reason why the quick out is for Marxists to be atheists, and to recognize Hegel as basically only having like a revolutionary method, but having conservative conclusions. Because then Marx makes that case by going through the philosophy of right. Really, what he says, my summary of Marx's critique of Hegel's philosophy of right is that Marx's critique of Hegel's philosophy of right is that he reconciles himself with the social order, if not necessarily the Prussian state. But I actually think that, you know, his discourse on the estates, like the agricultural estate, the industrial estate, and then the civil service as being the state itself as being the mediator of all of the various interests, with, you know, a sovereign and executive kind of standing above and personifying all of it, looks to me more like Bonaparte's system, or maybe even the kind of classical pre-Marxist German national socialism. And actually, I think his treatment of the estates looks a lot like, Chris, what you have outlined as being the, basically the Strasser model of the state. It's an all people's state. It tries to reconcile the antagonism of classes. And that's the real essence, I think, of Marx's criticism of it. Oh. Rather than it's the Prussian state and Hegel likes it. It's that it's the social order and Hegel accepts it.
So Strasser's conception of the state is really just a guild socialist conception of the state.
Absolutely. So,
but the thing that makes it Strasserist is that element of like racial national socialism. Actually, no, I mean, like, yeah, it is racial national socialism, but it's not biologically racial national socialism. But anyway.
Sure, right. And so that's not present in Hegel. But
no, not at all.
The corporatist state where the subjects and citizens participate through the guilds of their craft.
Yeah.
Where, you know, where everybody's material interests are reconciled, you know, are mediated through the institutions of the state, and everybody's spiritual interests are mediated through religion and philosophy, depending on, you know, depending on how deeply engaged you are with the project of absolute knowing, we sort of arrive at the final piece of Hegel's overall system, which is why the philosophy of right is at the end, because it's the culmination of everything and is the product of human reason. I think that I don't agree, right, with what Hegel sees as the desirable and ideal way to live. But I think that what's more important is what we have, again, I think already discussed in the other sections of this discussion, which is that, you know, this is, we have the tools in our hands through the existence of the modern state as a concept to perfect ourselves and to understand the world and to continually remake it in our own image, which is to say in the image of God. So the rational kernel in Hegel's treatment of the state as God on earth is that it's a product of man, which is God on earth.
And that was what I meant with the question on potentiality or actuality of the end of history.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. That's why I think going through this actually answers the question, because I think that that's right. I think that Hegel doesn't believe he's arrived at the end of development, but if you see stages in history as distinct eras in human development, the final one is the one he lives in. And I think if we think about communism as the riddle of history solved, you know, the end of class struggle and the end of history itself as culminating in the end of class society, we actually all already think what Hegel thinks. But we just don't think what Hegel thinks.
Exactly. But then to draw out that problem, perhaps not so much out of the textual actuality of Hegel, but that's more of the question that he's raising, is if we have reached that potentiality that the means of production have and knowledge and spirituality has developed to that point where the end of history is possible to achieve, that also means that we have been given freedom, and that freedom also encompasses the freedom to sin, to make the world into not the face of God, but the face of the devil, the face of evil, which is like basically what we have today, this, where we are making the world into a temple of mammon.
Mira, I'm glad you brought this up, because the thing I did want to add was that I think that the real key here is, again, have we tarried with the negative? Have we gone through that? Because if we have not, then we come back to what Hegel called sin or evil, which is essentially the subject subordinating otherness unto itself through its desire, with a capital D. And I think that's pretty clearly what we're looking at, is the stage of development. It's like the state is really, I think, an instrument of sin or evil, or the desire to negate otherness. And then the question would be, like, what is the state if it no longer negates otherness, but comes, like, but goes through otherness back to know the absolute, which maybe is, you know, this utopian ideal.
And if we do not stare with the negative as a collective humanity, then we will, and we are, regressing. We are not actualizing that freedom that God has given us, but shackling ourselves to our own desires and the desires of capital. And we are basically regressing back into feudalism.
Right. Well, and that's incidentally more or less what Marx accuses Hegel of doing by giving an exposition of the state in its ideal sense, which doesn't resolve class antagonisms, but merely mediates them through this guild system, through this corporatist structure, and with the existence of essentially with the existence of a king, right? So I do think, like, for our purposes, it's more important to retain the spirit rather than the letter of Hegel's law here, right? because if we're sticking to the letter, then we are in fact regressing. I think if we try to be, if we think the state is a non-ideological, just a tool, right? If we have a Bernstein, kind of reformist view of the state, then we will regress. As, McGee goes on, he points out that, you know, he points out later in the chapter that Hegel is really anti-utopian. He's very much against these schemes of trying to escape the state. He very much thinks that the state is a tool. It is a thing we can use, and that it is, you know, because it is the product of our reason and our effort. So I, you know, whatever, this is where he's wrong.
Yeah, but also the state was something different in the time of Hegel than in the time of Marx.
Sure.
I mean, to give Hegel credit, he didn't see the civil war in the USA, which Marx did, and I think actually also he didn't see the failure of the 1848, which I think actually changed Marx's views. Those mm-hmm. two events changed Marx's view of the state.
Well, right. So to find the through line in all of our discussions today, right? Like, this is truth in the moment. This is a historical truth, not a transhistorical truth, because the state in Hegel's day is the product of revolution, right? It's the result of dramatic upheaval and retransformation. And even in trying to negate it, right? Even as the Prussian state tries to resist Bonaparte, it has to adopt the methodology of the modern state. And so through the European, the series of wars in Europe, the cunning of reason works through even people trying to oppose the future, right? By they become unconscious agents of the future by trying to retain the past, right? By trying to retain their feudal privileges, they have to become architects of the modern state, which undoes the feudal privileges that they nominally are defending.
Yeah,
that was a big eye opener for me. Like, that's what the cunning of reason really is. It's, you know, like, it doesn't really matter what you're going to try to do. By virtue of being a participant in history, you are an agent of its development.
Yes, there is a really good book on this, Phantom of Terrors, the Phantom Terror, and it is about how the reaction to the French Revolution basically created the professional revolutionaries because the reaction to the French Revolution was so paranoid that it forced all these liberals who were just talking shit on bars underground to become professional revolutionaries. And that was what happened in Prussia, because they were so afraid of French revolutionaries or German revolutionaries, they created a centralized police to view them, and then forced all these intellectuals underground, and like it very much the cunning of reasons. It is also a book that looks on the creation of the police.
That's a well-burrowed old mole kind of moment. McGee says that Hegel regards his own views as closer to the original Christianity than that of the rational theology of his day. And I think we have already made the case pretty well. But it is worth saying that Hegel's philosophy of history is shaped entirely by his commitment to Christianity. It says that world history is governed by an ultimate design, that is a rational process, that world history is merely a series of manifestations of this one original reason. And then he further goes on to, he refers to the world spirit as the master workman, as it reveals itself through human consciousness, and that the relationship of human beings to this is that of single parts to a whole. So, you know, just in case it hasn't been made really clear through the many hours that we have dedicated to this conversation, once again, that is, you know, that's just restating it one more time. The relationship of human beings to God is as individual aspects of God. He refers to the cunning of reason as the invisible hand of spirit, which I just think is a really clever way of putting it.
Yeah.
He says that Christianity supplies us with the key to history because of its universalist aspects and its revealing of the truth that mankind has sought after and has grasped in part through various religions throughout time. And now we can get into the influences on these thoughts. So that's where Luria and Lurian Kabbalism comes in. And I don't know if it's really worth going into any particular detail, because I think it the chapter which deals with Kabbalism overall, the one that Adam kicked us off with, says most of what needs to be said there, I think. Like I wrote here, Luria says that each new act of creation is the result of a simultaneous expansion and contraction. And that's pretty similar to what's covered in past chapters, such as Lucifer as a moment of God.
One of the things I forgot to mention in the alchemy was the idea that all things are poison. And yeah. It's just the levels of within which they're concentrated. And that sort of is the negative embodied in the positive.
Which is just to say, once again, here it is on display in a different one of Hegel's works. So we don't know if Hegel had any direct relationship to Lurianic Kabbalism, but it's pretty clear that he had an indirect, he was indirectly influenced via Böhm and Oetinger and other people that we've already covered. And he also does mention Luria in his lectures on Kabbalah in the Philosophy of Religion. Then there's some examples of what exists in Hegel that exists in Luria's thought, like that the cosmic assignment of man is to perfect themselves, to realize the nature of concepts which I have not mentioned. Adam Kadam and Adam Rishon.
Adam Kadman.
Kadman? Oh, I can't read my own handwriting here. But basically, to lift the fallen created world up to its pure state of being in the light of God. Yeah, for man to raise himself above nature and to master it. And it kind of goes on like this for a while. It's like, again, here's an aspect of something we've covered, and here's another expression of it in another aspect of someone else's thought, which has been mentioned but hasn't been fully detailed. Because at this stage of the book, what McGee is really doing, I think, is coming to a conclusion, but without stating so, because he has to specifically talk about, you know, a couple more texts, and the critical one is the Philosophy of Right, I think. But we are treading really familiar ground at this point. Mm-hmm. One key difference between Hegel and Hegel's thought and Luria's is that he says that for Hegel, God is, or the absolute idea, is abstract and lacking full realization, and that for God to be God, he must realize himself in spirit, as we have said. So I think where we get to the kind of like the new ground, so to speak, I'm going to say this wrong, Joachimite mysticism.
And Joachimite.
Well, and it's Italian, so it's not even Joachim anyways, but Joachimite mysticism and the end of history, which we sort of prefigured, we sort of touched on in the last discussion. But Joachim's great innovation is to see history as having a structure and to move in stages. And similar to Hegel, he thinks he's living in the end of history. So he refers to the age of the father. That's the period of the obedience to the rules of God. And then that's the Old Testament. Then the age of the son, which is from Christ's time on earth through the establishment and spread of the church. And then the final age is the age of the Holy Spirit, the age of a new dispensation of universal love, transcending the gospel of Christ. And now it would be fully possible to know God. This is the shift from law and justice to the era of freedom, which at this point I think sounds very, very familiar to all of us. The difference is that this is in 1260, and as we know, Hegel hasn't even been born yet, so absolute knowing can't possibly have been achieved.
According to him, we're in the end of history since the 13th century.
Basically.
Yeah.
And if we wanted to be very charitable, we could say that a lot of the origins of modernity, right, in the early modern period, is not far away.
Yeah.
But it is centuries away.
Well, so according to in Hinduism, like, we've been in the Kali Yuga for at this point for 6,000 years or something like that. So, you know, you can cut the old Joachim of Fiore. Joachim of Fiore, a little bit of slack there,
right? I think what's important here is that this is a truth that is imminent, that is only possible for Hegel to pick up on because it has already been stated in some form. In this chapter, we return to the Jena fragment, right? The triangle of triangles, as an illustration of God's process of coming into consciousness of himself, and as a blueprint for Hegel's entire system. And again, that's we go through the triadic structure of God being essence, concept, Son, mechanics, physics, organics, and Holy Spirit, subjective, objective, absolute. To be perfectly honest, this chapter, it's a little boring because it is largely a restatement. To me, the really interesting material has to do with the philosophy of right. And that's what's largely skipped over, which is why for me, like adding Marx on Hegel back in is, to me, that's really the real substance of the discussion exists. But there is just some interesting history. When he does the comparison of Frederick William the First, right, Frederick the Great, as a master mason and an exemplar of Enlightenment despotism, and then Frederick William the Second, his son, as an anti-rationalist and who's very opposed to reform and is a Rosicrucian instead of a mason, and then Frederick William the Third, the grandson, as just sort of a dullard with no convictions of his own. You see the rapid degeneration of the Prussian state in these three generations. But I do think it raises an interesting question about the Rosicrucian and Masonic experiences overall, because McGee points out, he points to, I'm sorry, it's not McGee, it's someone named Henri Braunschweig, refers to men seeking wisdom and joining the Masons and not really finding any, and finding that it's largely a myth that there is esoteric wisdom to be found. And so then that's a lot of who the Rosicrucians are people who are kind of frustrated with Masonry not really giving them what they came to find. And that there is a similar slide in Hegel's thought from 1795 to 1821 as basically a drift from radical liberalism to conservatism. So that leads me to a question, which is, can we regard Hegel as having done that? Drifting from radicalism to conservatism. Because that's the more or less the conclusion of the chapter, which is also, I think, the final pronouncement that is made on Hegel by, whether for good or for ill, by most commentators on Hegel, is that over time, as in his youth, he's the product of Enlightenment and revolution. And then as he grows older and becomes a little wiser and finds a decent job and finishes working out his philosophical system, he becomes a conservative and reconciles himself to what he refers to as recognizing that reason is the rose and the cross of the present, and that it's necessary in order to enjoy the present. The rose and the cross symbolism is listed here as basically like regeneration, birth, and the sort of union of the temporal and spiritual. So McGee's kind of summary of Hegel's trajectory is that his full enlightenment comes with reconciling himself to the present, and that our task as individuals and as a society is to, accept it, but to regenerate it, to seek union of the temporal and spiritual as a project of the self, right? And that's what philosophy is for.
I mean, one question I would have thinking about this is the question whether it is solely about Hegel reconciling himself and becoming more conservative, or is it about a larger movement of history and the historical period and Hegel being a part of that? And can we hold those two together?
That's a good question. I think you can understand Hegel, the individual, without situating him in his historical period, right? So I think you have to hold them together.
Well, Hegel lived through the failures and disillusionment. Like, I think the greatest equivalence would be like if you basically the fall of the Soviet Empire. He lived through the 90s and the aughts through all of his life, basically. And then you become, I don't think we necessarily have to read Hegel as a large C conservative, as a political conservative, but I think that it is not unreasonable to see that his political optimism, his optimism doesn't disappear. His belief in reason and the possibility of man to reach gnosis and reach Christ, But I think that he these grand ideas of a new religion of putting philosophy at work within society gradually disappears within Hegel because of the times that lived in where that was not possible. Just like during the 90s and the aughts, most Marxists degenerated to like Blairites or Clintonites.
Hegel, I think, sits at the head of the source of a philosophical like stream. Mm-hmm. Like he's upstream of a myriad of philosophical ideas and political ideas, political interpretations that are conceived of through this Hegelian formula, either consciously or not. And I think that it's sort of anachronistic to, you know, to assign him a conservatizing or radicalizing role. I think that, like, yes, is the answer to that question.
I think that's right, because I think what's critical for Hegel, and McGee does draw out this distinction between Hegel and Marx, is that Hegel isn't trying to figure out where the world is going. He's trying to explain where the world is and how it got there. So Hegel is only going to be as radical as reality itself. His thought is only going to be, his conclusions are only going to be as true as the historical truth that they embody. I do think McGee's a little bit wrong in saying that Marx is the one making predictions. But if we look at the historical sweep of events just in Hegel's own lifetime, from the sort of age of enlightenment through the age of revolution, and, you know, through the French Revolution and Napoleonic Wars and up to the Congress of Vienna, and then in the immediate post-revolutionary wave, he lives through the crescendo, right? The consummation of a whole epoch in which the entirety of human existence is reformed and reshaped. So contained within that historical moment, that is true. That is what he's saying is true, that this is the end of it. This is the conclusion. We can say also, I think we can say that if we stick to the spirit of what Hegel, presents to us as necessary for absolute knowing, I think that it's also the case that there is no final end to any of this, that the end of history is an unfolding process at an entire period. And what makes it the end of history for Hegel is only that we have the full capacity now to engage with it as conscious subjects, not only to change the world, but to interpret it so that we can be full and conscious in human development itself. I think we can forgive him for not predicting modern communism. And I also think we can not castigate him for thinking, oh, this is as far as can be seen, right? Because if the owl of Minerva spreads its wings only at the falling of dusk, what we're really talking about is criticizing Hegel for doing exactly that. Looking back on what has been up to a point and saying, I understand.
And he understands that freedom and that knowledge gives us the freedom to either create the world in the image of God or in the image of mammon.